Welcome to Pints of Politics here at the Barley House on 109, 1450 and ConcordNewsRadio.com. Pints of Politics is presented by New England College in this hour of the program, brought to you by Riverbend Community Mental Health and Choices in H Addiction Recovery Services. I'm with New Hampshire's Political Zen Master, Professor of Political Science at SNHU. He is Dean Spotus as we anxiously await the arrival of former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, who is once again considering running for president. A quick trip to the Granite State. He spoke to Democrats, he spoke to students up at Dartmouth. I should assume many of them were Democrats, and also did politics and eggs as well as doing pints and politics with us. And first off, I think that certainly O'Malley is looking at running for president, but there are a lot of folks who are looking at running for president.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like it started probably earlier than ever. Whenever you're going to have an open seat in the presidency, it always draws a lot of interest. I think 2016 was a little atypical because Hillary Clinton was such a big presence in the race early on, and then it very quickly became her against Bernie Sanders, and Martin O'Malley was in the mix for a while as well, and then ultimately didn't work out for him this time, that time. So we'll see. I mean, he's been a regular presence in the state. We've seen him up here a number of times. We're still way away from 2020, but you know, we're seeing a number of candidates, potential presidential candidates, coming up here, spending time, getting involved in the 2018 midterms. It's a way to make connections. It's a way to maintain your visibility. So I'm interested to see what his shorter-term plans are. Yeah, obviously, he'll probably be noncommittal about running for president, although, you know, at this point, I think it's pretty clear he's thinking about it. But we're interested to see what he's got in store for 2018 before we get on to the presidential race.
Right. And let's, you know, talk a little bit about, you know, what this pre-primary process is like, the invisible primary.
Right.
And, you know, certainly there is a jockeying that takes place for individuals who are looking to, you know, court activists, individuals who are going to work on their campaigns. And if you are an individual who is not necessarily as well known as others, or if you did not have a great finish as O'Malley did in the 2016 election, it is incumbent upon you to get in here early and start to develop some relationships.
Yeah, his situation is particularly challenging because my sense is, and maybe you'll disagree or agree, he got a pretty close look here in New Hampshire in the 2016 cycle. He spent a lot of time up here. We did a number of shows with him. He was in a number of the televised debates. He's probably not going to be as well known as Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, but nonetheless, he gave it a pretty hard run the last time around. So he really has to hope that there's something fundamentally different about the openness of the seat this time around, or the nomination this time around, that he won't be blocked in perhaps the way he was by the power of the Sanders-Clinton face-off.
And we'll get into that when we return. Martin O'Malley is here. It's Pints of Politics at the Barley House. I'm Chris Ryan, Pints of Politics, presented by New England College. We'll come back with more after this. Welcome back here at the Barley House. It's Pints and Politics, presented by New England College. I am Chris Reinwald of Dean Spotus. Honored to welcome the former governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley, who is in the Granite State, partook in politics and eggs up at Dartmouth College as well. And he's been in New Hampshire a lot over the last couple of years after the presidential election, working for Democratic candidates at the state level. And he is back with us here today, considering a run for president, and I appreciate you joining us for the program.
Thank you, Chris. Good to see you. And Dean.
So we'll start with,
I love your Main Street, by the way.
It
looks
really
awesome,
has
we were saying
nice
on the break.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's a project that really came to fruition, and when you first started running, I remember you came in the studio, and it was a mess.
A lot of mud.
There was a lot of mud.
The
Main Street was a mess. And, so things are much better, obviously, now.
Yeah, it was worth it.
There's befitting a lot more of a life. State capital, yeah.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I mean, it feels like it feels much better downtown now. And it also looks like it, you know, has always been here, which is a good thing as well when you have a new project of,
that's a good scale,
of this nature. So we're talking a lot about your visit here today and, you know, what this means for you moving forward. Obviously, you're asked to speak at Politics and Eggs. You've been here a lot. You're working with candidates. What do you see your political future being?
Yeah, look, I know that this is what I know for sure. I know that in this year, when there's 36 governor's races up all across our country, every member of Congress and 36 state legislative races, that all of us have to become more active rather than less. And so that's what I'm going to do. And I'm, you know, there's some words to a song. I'm steady thinking, my way is clear. I know what I will do tomorrow. Mm-hmm. What I will do is help other people win back their states. And so that's what I've been doing. Whether or not I run for president again is still an open question in my heart and mind. Having done it once, I probably have a better appreciation than most what it takes. And in the meantime, I'm doing some teaching. I'll be at the Kennedy School at Harvard, where I'm headed after today for a couple of days there. I had 187 kids every Thursday night in class at College Park, Maryland, last semester. I'm writing a book that goes along with that course. But really, I've enjoyed last year, gentlemen, I was in 21 states for 36 different candidates, including a couple of up here, Kevin Kavanaugh, in his special election victory. I did not campaign for Carrie Lerner, but I saw her right after her race, where she won a Donald Trump plus 23 district by 4 points. But what I've seen all across the country is our Democratic candidates are doing 15 to 20 points better on election day than anybody might have guessed. And it's in some of the most unlikely places. In Oklahoma, where I campaigned for two different candidates, we have now won as a party 5 of the 7 special elections in that state where Donald Trump won by the largest amount. So, and most of these candidates tell me they learn right away, don't talk about Trump. Talk about us.
Are you working for these candidates and campaigning through some sort of organization or infrastructure you've set up, or are you just taking it on a case-by-case basis? I mean, is there going to be any kind of sort of, you know, I'll come campaign for you, and I can even help you out with some funding, and then, you know, maybe if I decide to run, we can talk down the road?
Yeah, look, I do everything I can without asking or expecting anything back.
You don't have a formal organization set up?
No, actually we do.
You do, okay.
We call it Win Back Your State. So we have recommitted my leadership pack, and that is the name, Win Back Your State. And we had a fundraiser at home in Baltimore a couple weeks ago with my Irish band on St. Patrick's weekend. And that'll allow me to get on Southwest flights and go places and help candidates. So what I'm able to do, Dean, is that, I mean, you asked, do I have an organization? Sure. When you run for president, you have to set up a 50-state organization just to get on the ballot, which is a challenge when you're totally unknown and scrapping to break threshold in Iowa or make it in New Hampshire. So in a sense,
I have a lot of pre-existing infrastructures there. Yeah.
I have friends in some place, and what makes this enjoyable for me, in addition to helping good people, is that sometimes I get to meet O'Malley for president people in Sarasota, Florida, that I'd never met before because our campaign didn't get there.
Right.
But by going in as we did for Margaret Good in her special election, we email our list, she emails hers. She's able to raise $25,000 in a state rep race, which is real money and can make a big impact. And the fact of my coming helps get her on local television and local newspaper and gins up her people. I found when I was governor that a lot of national Democrats almost looked down their nose at campaigning in state races, which also goes a long way to explain why we got so badly shellacked as a party in 2010. Shame on us. That'll never happen again. This is the year we win back our states to save our country.
I want to dive into, you know, your lessons from running for president a little bit, and how that kind of informs you, you know, moving forward. And you look back at 2016, and Hillary Clinton was the assumed nominee. And there were two other candidates, yourself and Bernie Sanders. A lot of folks looked at your candidacy as being, you know, the pragmatic progressive who's accomplished things. And then all of a sudden, Bernie Sanders was able to take off, whether it was his persona, his delivery, his passion, the fact that he was an angry candidate in an angry election, I think had a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
When you look back at 2016, I mean, what do you see as the rationale for why you did not have success, and how does that inform you moving forward?
The why didn't you take off question. I think so much about politics is timing. In other races that I have run, sometimes even from, you know, starting off as an unknown and with very little time, the timing was in my favor. In this year, as you just described it, Chris, I think anger was the animating emotion of not only the two primary contests, but right down the final stretch in the general election. Vice President Gore asked me when I had come home in March. I saw him. He spoke at College Park. And afterwards, he kindly asked, he said, what surprised you the most about your experience out there? I said, you know, Mr. Vice President, it wasn't the depth of the anger or the breadth of it. It was the patience of it. It was as if people wanted to just pull into the angry lane, park the car, and throw the keys out the window. And they weren't leaving till they had their satisfaction of sending the loud message to their national politicians that it wasn't working for them and wasn't working for their families. And you know what? It was not an irrational anger altogether. Wages have been going down. We have had an unprecedented concentration of wealth in the hands of the few, and therefore power in the hands of the few. A government that seems to make decisions as if, you know, we've lost track of the truth that we need to put people first in our economic equations. And against that backdrop, people had their moment of protest. You know, sadly, ironically, tragically, it resulted in electing a president who adopted and pushed policies that exacerbate income inequality rather than alleviate it. But there is that was the time, yeah. You know, and I never found in my own service that anger, rage, and retribution were helpful emotions when it comes to building a consensus or getting tough things done. We should expect passion from our leaders, but I don't think that anger is actually a very helpful emotion.
Speaking of anger, I witnessed an interesting debate between a couple of acquaintances a few days ago, Democrats, over the appropriate strategy for 2018.
Was it Easter?
It was a proper discussion for Easter, of yeah. course. But anyway, the dinner conversation got into a debate, and the one person
was going to say a mess.
Yeah, no, it was actually people were pretty well behaved. But one individual was arguing that that the Democrats really the problem is they for 2018 they don't have a positive message. They need to have a positive message. And the other person was saying no. You know, Trump is so problematic as president, and there's so much anger among the base that it's almost pointless to even worry about having some other message. We saw the Democrats try the House and Senate leadership try a while back to have I think it was like better jobs, better economy. There was this sort of trial balloon of a message. So I'm interested in your, you know, even if you take anger out of the equation, to what extent, how do you balance the Democrats need a positive message versus Democrats need to mobilize their base by talking about the failures of Trump as president?
Yeah. I'm going to share with you what I've heard from the candidates out there
sure.
that are winning.
Sure.
Because whenever I go in, you might imagine, Dean, I pull them aside for my 2 minutes of tell me
yeah.
what you're hearing.
How's it going?
Right. Tell me what you're saying. Tell me what's resonating. And what each of these candidates across the country, Washington State, Iowa, New Hampshire, Florida, other places, Oklahoma, almost two themes emerge in terms of what they hear on the doors. They hear that people's levels of anxiety are very high about two things. One is, we still feel as a people that our leaders don't listen to us, or they don't care, or they've been somehow bought off or corrupted by big money. The second thing that they hear, the big anxiety, is that people feel like that their children are going to do less well than they have, that their kids won't be better off. And sometimes that's expressed in terms of, I can't pay my bills. My husband and I are now working three jobs between the two of us, and yet healthcare goes up, college affordability. So those things are all very much there. What our candidates tell me that they are saying that people are listening for in a different way now is this. Those messages of solidarity, in other words, that we're all in this together, that we're Democrats, Republicans, and independents, but we have to listen to each other if we're going to solve our problems. And you heard Connor Lamb out in Pittsburgh, the phrase that he used that was so resonant. I used it on election night. I'm sure not for the first time. He said, we elect and send Congress people to Washington to attack our problems, not to attack each other. I believe that the message from the National Democratic Party that's emerging is this, that we need to save our democracy. That means putting it forward certain reforms that push back against the influence of big money, that enshrine perhaps even in the Constitution the right to vote, that make it easier for people to vote, not harder, that move us past partisan redistricting and gerrymandering and drawing our congressional borders. But the second part of that message is we need to make economic reforms that will guarantee that our children are winners in a changing economy and not losers in a changing economy. Now, each of these candidates says that in a different way, and it is a very distributed Democratic message, but it is a Democratic message. If you had to put it in just two words, it would be people first.
But, you know, I mean, I could make that argument and couch it in a critique of Trump, or I could make that argument and couch it in a set of policy reforms. And I guess I'm wondering, how do you develop some sort of policy agenda separate from a critique of the president? How do you deal with Trump?
Yeah, this is what these, again, our successful candidates tell me. In fact, one here in your own state said to me, Martin, I probably wouldn't have been running except that Donald Trump motivated me to make this leap. But I learned after my first four or five doors, never bring up Trump.
So motivating, but not necessarily on top.
He is a tremendous gift. As Democrats, he has provided a tremendous couple of gifts for us, even with the bad things he's doing for our country. One of those things is we've never had a better tool for recruitment of good candidates than Donald Trump has provided. And secondly, he energizes the base in a way that all of the micro-targeting, a little, you know, repeated phone calls could never do.
Yeah.
And that's been why I think you've seen all across the country a 15 to 20-point shift in our direction. But our candidates, against the dark backdrop, if you will, that is Trump, are able to paint that brighter picture of what we can do together as a country to reform our politics and to make our children winners in a changing economy.
I'm going to bring up a topic of conversation that Dean and I actually had the other day in regards to, you know, where the country is headed in the 2018 midterms. And you mentioned, you know, Connor Lamb and his race in Pennsylvania. And he was a moderate Democrat. He took positions which were kind of Republican in a lot of certain areas. And I feel that, as you referenced, that the base is automatically motivated and is going to come out for anything that's against Donald Trump. The problem is the individuals who are in the middle, where they may not like what Donald Trump is selling. They may not like how he is operating as president. But a Bernie Sanders progressive who talks in hyperbole, very similarly to Trump, and the promises that they make, is not desirable to that individual either. So is there a concern on your part that the party is being shifted not just too far off to the left, because you indeed are a progressive, but that you're drifting into a place where you're making promises and saying things that just aren't possible or feasible to achieve as progressives, and you lose the middle?
The great question. I would answer it this way. I think we need to speak to where our country's going. And I think the greatest guide to where our country's going is found in the attitudes of our young people. The attitudes of our young people happen to be 180 degrees different than the attitudes of Donald Trump. They believe our diversity is our strength. They are 80% plus for, you know, immigration reform. They believe that climate change is real and their nation should be doing something about it. Mm-hmm. They also believe that our economy is rapidly changing and we're not doing enough to help them have the skills and get the break they need to, you know, to buy a home if they choose or start a family. They're feeling that crunch, certainly. And so I think we need to speak to where our country's going. I know it's easy. I know that we're accustomed to looking at the left-right continuum,
mm-hmm.
but I prefer to look at the forward versus back continuum. Sometimes during the brief time I was on that presidential stage with Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders, people would ask me, are you to the left or to the right of them? I'd say, well, I think I'm to the forward of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I certainly had a more progressive opinion on and policies and actions in office on immigration and gun control than Bernie Sanders did.
Right.
And I was also more forward of Hillary Clinton on some other issues like minimum wage. And
I think one of your problems was your pragmatism, and that you seem like a reasonable individual, somebody who can work with both sides and create a positive resolution to a problem. And, you know, as you referenced before, that's not what folks are looking for in the last election. Now,
it was a unique year.
In 2020, What do you think folks are going to be looking for the anecdote to Trump, someone who is, like yourself, pragmatic, somebody who is not necessarily, quote-unquote, flashy? Or are they going to be looking for somebody who's loud, like a Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders, who's going to stand up to Trump and be able to offer a strength, but also a little bit more of a recognizable candidacy?
I think they're going to be looking for new leaders that can pull us together as a people. Hmm. I think that's what they're going. I think that's what we're looking for as a country. I was just over at St. Anselm's and repeated a story that I experienced when I went to before a bunch of kids at Suffolk College, young Democrats, and a young man asked, "What do you think the biggest problem is facing the country?" And I said to him, "Trust, or lack of trust
in institutions and individuals.
Institutions, big banks, millionaires, billionaires. This minority group, that minority group, this religious group. That, I mean." And our kids understand it, and they're going to have to help us unpack that baggage. But I think the general public understands we need new leadership that can pull us together, that's not part of the divisive battles of the past. And I think that's what people will be looking for, and there'll be a host of them, I'm sure, offering their talents to people in this next presidential race.
That is Martin O'Malley, former governor of Maryland, 2016 presidential candidate, joining us here for Pints and Politics at the Brawley House. I'm Chris Reinold of Dean Spilotis. We'll take a quick break and come back. Pints and Politics presented by New England College. Welcome back. It's Pints of Politics here at the Brawley House. I'm 1-9, 1450 and ConcordNewsRadio.com. Kind of a sleepy day here in the capital of the state of New Hampshire. Still a little bit cold out there for the April calendar month, but we are enjoying ourselves here at Pints of Politics with the former governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley. I'm Chris Reinold of Dean Spilotis. This hour of the program presented by Reuben Community Mental Health and Choices NH Addiction Recovery Services. And Pints of Politics presented by New England College. Go ahead, Dean.
And just following up on our real quick on our earlier conversation before the break, I think it'll be very interesting to see whether the electorate is moving back toward a more kind of consensual type of policymaking rather than the very polarizing politics we've seen recently. There's certainly that is one theory about where we're headed based on some of the opinion data. But let me shift gears a little bit and get your view on policy. In the last 4 to 6 months, we've gotten a really good look at what Trump fiscal policy looks like. We have the Trump tax cuts. We have the budget agreement that was just signed recently. So we now kind of see the trade-offs between tax cuts and increased spending. And I'm interested to hear whether there are what aspects of the tax policy and the spending policy you might tweak given what was just agreed upon in the last few months.
Look, I think overall that the dollars that we have now allocated as a country to tax cuts that benefit primarily the wealthiest of Americans and corporations was not a wise decision. Fiscally, the math eventually comes home to roost, and those decisions, the $1.5 trillion tax cut, puts us in a position of heading into red ink and making our national debt even worse. So I think that's bad. No people ever gave their kids a better future by making their own country weaker. Our parents didn't do that to us. Our grandparents didn't do that to us. In terms of the budget that was passed, the one that he threatened to veto for about an hour, I think a lot of people are still unpacking what's in it. I understand that there were actually some increases for places like the National Institute of Health or Center for Disease Control. I think that's a good thing. We have so dramatically cut research and development in our country. I hope that in fact we have increased that.
What about the bump in defense spending?
Overall, I believe that our federal budget has been out of balance for some years, allocating probably too much to defense and not enough to other discretionary things like research and development, affordable college, and we still have work to do to bring down the costs of health care, which are the highest in the developed nations and actually can be brought down if we put our shoulders into things that work, like moving our hospitals out of fee-for-service to global budgets and the like. It's a torrent of information that flies off of this Trump administration. It's hard to figure out which of it is actually settled and which of it is proposed.
In terms of much at health, and I'm curious as to what you think government's role or the president's role should be in regards to tackling some of the most significant health issues that our nation faces, whether it's cancer, or not just our nation, our world faces, whether it's cancer, heart disease, and things of that nature. Vice President Biden mentioned, a moonshot effort for cancer and things of that and diseases of that nature. What do you see as government's role in something like that?
Well, I think our federal government has a big role to play, not only in seeding the innovations that lead to cures, but also in making the investments that allow us to cure this planet and avert what most scientists believe is the beginning stages of a potentially sixth extinction event on this planet because of climate change. So there's so much that we can only do together through that common platform of ours, our federal government. And how are you, Sharon? And we've gotten away from it. So whether it's cures, whether it's new energy, new technologies, like we are headed into the third industrial revolution, mm-hmm. and we're largely stumbling backwards into it. We don't need to be. We should be able to win this just as we won the first and the second one, but it's not going to happen by investing less in research and development and innovation. So I'm for those things.
I'm interested in how you see the cycle changing in one of the key things that you mentioned previous, and that is individuals who are growing up today as high school students, as college students, who feel that having the same type of wealth and life that their parents have is something that's not necessarily achievable. How does that change in your view? Because it's obviously multifaceted. You mentioned wages, and wages have been stagnant, but we've seen incremental increases over a long period of time. But the costs of college, the costs of insurance, the costs that surround individuals,
housing.
The ones that create a fake middle class. I mean, we all have our incomes that come in, but then there's the debts that are there: health insurance costs, health care costs, and this to me seems to be the real issue of our times moving forward is that individuals are having overwhelming amounts of credit card, college debts, and can't find affordable housing as a result of that.
Yeah, all of these things are true, and these problems aren't going to solve themselves. The housing issue, as Dean chimed in, is a big chunk of what people pay in terms of their monthly, the monthly bills that a family has to worry about and barely even gets a mention. Look, there are some things that we do have done in every generation. We have always found a way to give our kids and our people the skills they need to compete and win as the economy changes, as technologies mm-hmm. change. We need to be doing that faster than we ever have, and instead we're not doing it at all. What do I mean by that? I mean the huge cuts that many states have made and the federal government's made to college tuition, and holding down the cost of college tuition means that the colleges have to get it from someplace, so that our universities are turned into toll roads. I believe that we could get to a point in a short period of time where every kid that graduates from high school not only has a diploma but has a year of college credit already under their belt, has a certificate and a skill, a trade that's actually in demand in today's economy. And much of it can come in information technology and coding and other things that right now people go looking for employees to find. In terms of housing, I work with the Smart Cities Initiative, and I interact with mayors not only across the country but around the world. Every major city and urbanization is a big threshold we crossed a couple years ago. A majority of us now live in cities. But every mayor wrestles with the challenges not only of safety but of affordable housing,
right,
and mobility. And the two go hand in glove. Cities should hold the key to that more sustainable future, but these things will not build themselves. We need to make the investment, and we have the ability to do it. We've shown that by the $1.5 trillion we put into tax cuts for the super wealthy and corporations. We need to have that same resolve to building up the common platform of ours, our country, and the investments we make in making college more affordable, housing, mobility, and the other solutions, the infrastructure of this third industrial revolution.
Sort of follow-up question on jobs and the economy. There's been some division among Democrats over trade policy, protectionism, whether or not we should have tariffs. Where do you come down on the kind of slowly increasing tariff war between the United States and China?
Yeah, my sense is that it's kind of welcome to the improv with the Trump administration. I don't think that they really have an idea for where this tariff war goes, and so you already see it escalating, and the Chinese have delivered a pretty pointed response that's also going to hurt some states worse than others. I believe that the best trade deals for the United States are those that actually raise conditions and pay for workers and not lowers them, that raises protections for the environment and doesn't lower them. I was opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and I believe that we should all be opposed to trade deals we're not allowed to read before our Congress has to vote on them. When you tour large parts of our country and see the shuttered factories that never came back after other prior trade deals, when you see what a failure we have been by way of any sort of retraining of workers and trade adjustment and those sorts of things, I think it's not hard to understand how so many people are opposed to any trade and believe that we've gotten the raw end of the deal on globalization. I think it's more of a mixed bag than that. But I think what Donald Trump was trying to accomplish by way of tariffs that are pushing us into this trade war, he probably could have accomplished with bigger investments in infrastructure and Buy American requirements on those appropriations.
Which are things he said he was going to do. Initially, that was going to be one of his – I mean, we've had Infrastructure Week about 40 times at this point. But that was one of the original things, was to have a robust infrastructure plan and a Buy American campaign. Martin
and
O'Malley –
he probably could have done for as much for steel doing that with the Buy American as you are
– right.
You know, pushing us into a trade war with a very big consumer nation now.
Martin O'Malley is with us here on the program, former governor of Maryland and 2016 presidential candidate, looking at running again for president in 2020 cycle. I want to ask you a little bit about wages. And you mentioned that earlier, that stagnant wages are one of the big issues that we have in the country. I'm not a big proponent of a minimum wage, because I think there's unintended consequences from that. But one of the problems that we have here in New Hampshire and in other places across the country are individuals who are making $8 to $12 an hour and working, you know, 40 hours a week. And that obviously is not sustainable if they're going to be productive members of society and able to afford homes and things of or apartments or things of that nature. And you mentioned the job retraining aspect of things previous. Why, in your view, are individuals working jobs from $8 to $12 an hour, 25 to 35-year-olds who previously were probably working in manufacturing or in realms similar? Why has there been this change and this shift where you have more haves and have-nots than perhaps previously before?
Yeah, well, there's been a big shift in our economic thinking over the last 30 years, and a number of forces have all kind of combined together to lead to a point where we have now the worst income inequality that we've ever had, and for the first time, that is to say, wealth concentrated in the hands of the few, and we also have wages that have stagnated or in some cases actually gone down over the last 10 years for a lot of people. There are several points. Let me rattle them off, not in order. One of them is the removal of what used to be how shall we say, kind of escalators on the bottom rung of the earning
right
ladder, a sort of a floor, if you will. We would continually, Democrats and Republicans alike, vote to raise the minimum wage from time to time, the notion being that no American should play by the rules, work a 40-hour week, and have to raise their child in poverty. You know, so that's a household of two with one breadwinner mm-hmm. should not have to raise their child in poverty. We got away from that in the 80s. We stopped doing it as regularly. Then we started going long periods of time without doing it at all. And then when we would do it in a way that never really caught up with inflation or the rising cost of things. Similarly, we stopped raising the threshold on overtime pay, that point at which an employer has to pay time and a half. Third, we passed laws that made it harder for people to organize and join labor unions and bargain collectively. They called that right to work, and state after state, in essence, passed laws that made it very, very difficult, if not illegal, for labor unions to operate. We also started looking the other way at concentrations of monopoly power in all sorts of markets. We came up with this notion of consumer convenience, that monopolies are good to a point. But the problem was we never drew the line on where that point was. And so monopolies continue to concentrate. And then on top of that, we eliminated the ability of our own nation to invest in the skills of our people and making learning more affordable for every family by instead putting a higher value on tax cuts for the wealthiest of us, which only exacerbated the income inequality problem and also removed our flexibility to make the investments in human capital and learning that would allow our people to keep pace with technological changes.
Yeah, but I mean, what you just touched on there, for me, a lot of people talk about the issue of automation, technology, the job economy. You know, the argument is that even if President Trump can bring additional manufacturers to the United States, the products are going to be built with robots, not people who are in lifelong jobs at a particular factory.
Huge issue.
You now have people living off of apps where, you know, maybe you drive for a car service like Uber, and then you on another app you're doing odd jobs or dog walking or carpentry or what have you. It's just the technology and automation have had a big impact.
And there's the natural flow of the economy, of course, which, as you referenced, you know, individuals are perhaps not making the best choices for, you know, the sustained long-term due to the sustained long-term economic impacts. But an individual is not as interested in shopping at a Toys R Us, and they'd rather purchase their things off Amazon. So as a result, Toys R Us goes out, and you know, you have a lot of individuals there, some working a little bit above minimum wage, and some working in decent positions there. They're all let go, and the box stores are moving out, and retail is changing. So retail seems to be retail seems to be going in the exact same direction as, you know, the manufacturers went, and Amazon is causing that. And, of course, the president and people and their buying habits. And, of course, the president has gone after Amazon. I'm not sure how much that has to do with Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post and how much it has to do with Amazon. But do you think that, though, he is right in some ways about wanting to, you know, to crack down on a monopoly like an Amazon?
Not for the reasons he wants to crack down on them. I think, look, both of you guys mentioned a number of things that are all part and parcel of this third industrial revolution. Industrial revolutions come about when a combination of technologies and communication, energy, and mobility all come together to create a total system change. The first industrial revolution, which Britain was a leader of, was steam power, right? Engines, it was coal, the automated printing, the telegraph. The next one, we were a big leader on. You know, oil, right? Cars. Telephones, and now we're in the midst of a third one. Usually the second or third largest group of employers or jobs in any state is usually among men is the job of driver of cars or trucks or delivery vehicles. What happens in an age of automation when we have autonomous vehicles? What happens to those individuals? This happens in every in every industrial revolution, and we are not having the conversations that we need to with our shoulders facing square ahead that puts people in the center of this equation. I mean, just because we have a sharing economy doesn't mean that people should have to retire into poverty. Doesn't mean that people shouldn't be able to have health insurance benefits. We need to figure this out, and the technology is there to help us do it. Yes, it'll create disruption, but the timeless American principles that the more our people learn, the more they earn, the more they earn, the more they spend, the more economy grows, those things are all still true. You know, guys, I've been looking over your shoulder at Teddy Roosevelt grinning at me over there on the wall with his hat. I mean, back in another time of industrial change and the need for political reform and concentrated power, we elected a person like Teddy Roosevelt that was willing to go in there and break up the trusts and fight for us. And he said in one articulation of our country, which I think is worth repeating, and I've written it down for you and for me today. He said, "Our republic has no justification unless it is a genuine democracy, a democracy economically as well as politically, a democracy in which there is a real and sincere effort to realize the ideal of equal opportunity for all." What he said then is what people want to hear now, and they want leaders not just at the national level but at their own state houses to put people first and to be willing to fight so that every family in America can make their kids winners in this latest period of unprecedented industrial change.
Governor O'Malley, as always, great to see you, and I look forward to seeing you again soon. Martin O'Malley here on Pints of Politics at the Barley House. I am Chris Ryan. This hour of the program presented by Reuben Community Mental Health and Pints of Politics, presented by New England College. Welcome back. It's Pints of Politics here at the Barley House. 1-9-1450 and ConcordNewsRadio.com. I am Chris Reinhold of Dean Spilotis. This hour of the program presented by Reuben Community Mental Health and Choices NH Addiction Recovery Services and Pints of Politics presented by New England College. Dean, your takeaways.
Yeah, it was a very interesting conversation. We learned a lot about what Governor O'Malley has in mind for this election cycle. You know, we've talked a lot about a number of current and former elected officials who have been up here working with candidates, providing support through their organizations, and he seems to be continuing on in that tradition. You know, at some point, he'll turn his attention to thinking about perhaps running for president again, but that's not his primary focus at this point. And I thought he articulated a good sort of overarching view of where we are right now and where he thinks we should head in terms of, you know, improving the conditions for individuals.
Well, Dean, as always, appreciate you joining us.
Sure thing, Chris.
That is Dean Spilotis. I am Chris Ryan. You've been listening to Pints and Politics here at the Barley House, presented by New England College. This hour of New Hampshire Now, brought to you by Reuben Community Mental Health. Whether you're thinking about moving your career forward or attending college for the very first time, New England College offers a wide variety of programs to help you achieve your goals. New England College offers over 35 undergraduate programs and 20 master's programs, online, on-site, and on campus. NEC's faculty are experienced experts in their field and deliver practical, hands-on learning designed for tomorrow's careers. To find out more about New England College, we encourage you to check out nec.edu. Again, that's nec.edu.
Hi, this is Dr. Andrew Albee, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about my practice, Suncook Dental. It may sound a bit cheesy, but I believe that dentistry is not about crowns or implants or fillings. I believe it's about improving people's quality of life. To that end, our focus here is doing our best to find out how to do just that. We perform most aspects of dentistry, but our specialty is helping you make the best possible decision for yourself and for your family, and then following through with that plan. I encourage you to learn more about Suncook Dental at suncookdental.com, and we look forward to meeting you.
This message is brought to you by New Futures.
My name is Dan. I'm a veteran and a Granite Stater. After serving our country for 32 years, I now work to help other veterans access the health care they deserve. What is not commonly known is that many homeless veterans receive their health care through Medicaid expansion, not through the VA. If New Hampshire does not reauthorize Medicaid expansion, countless veterans who depend on this life-saving program will lose their health care. Please call your lawmakers and ask them to support Medicaid expansion and New Hampshire's veterans.